Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton. I'm the creator and host of this series, and for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep, ongoing public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a real and telling role in helping human beings rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now held almost 100 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at BeyondAwakeningSeries.com, they're all available for free download at BeyondAwakeningSeries.com/blog. Today, you'll hear me in conversation with Thomas Huebel. We're going to continue that discussion, listening in on a conversation that Thomas and I had some weeks ago that was titled, Higher Consciousness Under Fire, Where's Your Samadhi When the Bombs Start Falling? You'll hear us in conversation for about 30 minutes, and then I'll make a few announcements, and we'll resume for another half hour. Because this is pre-recorded, we won't take questions, so the total broadcast will last, a little over an hour today. Thomas Huebel is a fresh and original contemporary spiritual teacher whose work teaches people what he calls spiritual competence, increased awareness and freedom in relation to the subtle animating energetics that create the gross world and everything we experience. His work embraces shadow work in dialogue in real time, social action. His special focus is inner cultural healing. He's organized and led several large healing events in Germany focusing on the Holocaust and has brought together thousands of Germans with many Israelis, including Holocaust survivors, to acknowledge, face, and heal the cultural shadow left by the Holocaust. This is an ongoing aspect of his work in Germany. He also lives in Israel with his partner, Yehudit Sisportis, a prominent Israeli artist, and their baby daughter. Thomas embraces integral philosophy and the creation of a new we. He has a powerful, spacious presence that opens up a profoundly clear, deep, and bright subtle field. And he works to bring forth the enlightened potential of a new, higher we in a way that he and I have taught and investigated together fairly extensively. He founded and leads the Celebrate Life Festival each summer in Oldenburg, Germany. Over 10 days, over 1,200 people come to participate in a beautiful scene with tents camped around a lake, a conscious mini Woodstock of the spirit. His Academy of Inner Science and Inner Science USA offer the Timeless Wisdom Training, a 2- and 3-year program by application. Those programs teach not only a personal transcendence, but active responses to the contemporary challenges of the human condition. He's now teaching actively in the USA, and we'll be offering the Timeless Wisdom Training here starting later this year. Thomas and I have always just clicked in conversation. We've had a lively, investigative, catalytic series of conversations, and we're good friends who talk regularly anyway. So I was very aware and concerned for him and his family when Hamas was bombarding Israel during the recent war in Gaza. So about 2 months ago, after a very lively private conversation that we realized we ought to share more broadly, he and I found time to record the conversation that follows now.
Well, Thomas, I'm happy we've been able to find this time to get together and have a conversation about some of the things that you had the challenging opportunity to observe when you were in Tel Aviv during the Gaza war, and there were missiles coming down, and you found yourself in a new life situation, and were able to observe some things that you hadn't seen quite so distinctly until then.
Right. Yeah, first of all, thank you for having this conversation with me. And it was like a very intense and also, of course, challenging experience. We which I think is a very important experience for everyone who does some consciousness or inner development work or, you know, higher development work. Because I think in these extreme situations, you get confronted with very basic needs like surviving or, you know, your basic life security. And I think many people that are, including myself until then, you know, that are practicing some sort of inner work or contemplative practice, are living in very peaceful environments, I mean, with daily challenges, but not with such fundamental impact on your life base. And I thought it, after we had some conversations around it, and then we had the idea together to explore this a bit more. What does this really mean in terms of inner development, and what are the challenging aspects on our humanity, on us as human beings, but also on cultivating higher capacities, and how stable are those higher capacities in extreme life situations? And I think that's a very interesting conversation to have. How stable is my presence, my inner connectedness, my expanded worldview, my higher value system, when, you know, our life base is threatened? And or do they disintegrate and collapse into very basic life patterns, collect individually and also collectively? And what is the, let's say, the collective force that builds up that affects everyone in it? And I think if we look at challenges like global warming or maybe food shortage or any kind of resource problems, so to speak, you know, in the next decades we might end up in some of those challenges. And so I think that's the conversation for today, I think.
Yeah. Well, when we first spoke after you were in that situation, you described suddenly hearing an air raid siren and having 90 seconds to get into an air raid shelter or a stairwell or someplace that was relatively safe, and how you'd never been in a situation like that before, and how you observed the effect on people's psyches being something you'd not seen quite in the same way before, because you hadn't been in this situation. And it was a sobering reflection. I'd love to hear you go ahead and describe what you observed.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that that what for me was clearly to feel in the whole experience is that at the beginning, that when the, you know, this was just was weeks of this kind of life, but at the beginning, that immediately when the sirens went off, that there was a kind of a immediate change, of course, in the whole collective field. So, you know, I live in Tel Aviv, and usually that's a very vibrant and colorful and alive and, you know, even a very touristy city. But at that moment, you could feel, and that was something that was there for some weeks after, is the a very strong contraction. And I've never experienced such a collective, you know, survival fear, survival instinct, and also, in a way, contraction, and in the following weeks, a seeming polarization also in politics, in in demonstrations, in the way I heard people speak about it, and I found that some people could really manage to keep their value system or their perspective quite high, like their usual perspective. But I also had the feeling that for some people, this really started to the higher functions of inclusivity, of compassion, of taking someone else's perspective started to fall apart quite quickly. And I think what happens then is a very strong polarization of good and bad and right and wrong, which also is important maybe to take some fast and life-saving decisions. So I think it also serves something. But it's interesting, I found it interesting in terms of how sustainable are those higher functions of compassion and love and seeing the perspective of the people that you have a conflict with. And how much this is a function that we can trust will be there. Because now, for example, if you look at global warming, it seems like, some scientists ring the alarm bells and things seem to change, but there is not a serious impact yet on our, existence. But if that should change, and we will not be able to turn this around, I'm asking the question, how much of those higher capacities can we trust in serious crisis moments? And it started a bit 2008 with the financial crisis, but what if this gets stronger? Do we really keep our initial inspiration, creativity, inclusivity of other people, or do we go back to those survival patterns that are simply much older in evolution and therefore more sustainable, and we see, feel, and act from that place? And I think that's an interesting discussion to have when we are so much talking about evolution of consciousness.
Right. Well, the work that many of us are involved in has been kind of predicated on the sense that human beings are facing problems now that can't be solved, in the famous quote from Albert Einstein, with the same consciousness that created them. And so part of the reason that so many people have gotten involved in spiritual work has been this sense that they could be part of a higher consciousness and could create a healing on the planet. And the development of higher states of consciousness and higher stages of consciousness has been something that many thousands of people have cultivated with the hopes of being a healing influence in the world that would make a difference. But if we think of these capacities as being very labile, very subject to the external state, then under stress they collapse and they're not going to be there as a source of wisdom. And in integral theory, one of the main distinctions Ken Wilber makes between high states of consciousness and high stages is that states come and go, that they're dependent on the state of the body-mind, the state of the subjectivity, and the state would change when the bombs fly. But that stages of consciousness, vertical development in Wilber's system, is supposed to be robust and not to collapse. And yet there are a lot of intricate connections between our state and our stage of consciousness, and I think your capacity to sense the subtle field and the state of other people, is quite developed. And having just had this fresh opportunity to witness all this and reflect on its implications, I'm curious, how you think this relates to those distinctions.
Right. Yeah, the question is the question that I'm asking now after this situation, I mean, now it's already some months ago, is that really true that those stage developments are so robust? Or are they also starting to crumble? And so that's a discussion that I didn't interview now thousands of people during that time and see how they really feel and how they keep up their value systems and their perspectives. But my feeling was that the whole collective consciousness goes into, of course, a very strong fear, and we are talking about a society that doesn't experience this for the first time. You know, there's already a kind of a collective competency in here in the Middle East in dealing with war situations.
Right.
And so first of all, there is this competency, and how would it look like without that competency? Let's say if a country experienced this, it's really for the first time for many people. And then also, how long does a stage development need to be in place for it to be stable enough? And if it's fairly new for the person or the part of society, so if you're now talking about, let's say, second-tier consciousness, is how stable is that perspective if it's fairly young? Because my experience was that the functions in consciousness that are there for already, I don't know, thousands of years, are definitely more stable than higher functions that might be there maybe since 30 years or 50 years or maybe 10 years. So that's a very interesting reflection that I thought that I had at that time. But what does this mean about our, let's say, problem-solving capacities when we are under stress, and not just the daily stress that we experience that, in our relationships or workplaces, things go up and down, but if there is a serious threat to the life condition, the base that we are living from, so what are the higher capacities of inspiration, creativity, originality and innovation that we can really count on, or do we really go back to the past and solve it again with the perspectives that we already had maybe 200 years ago, 100 years ago? And then we are back to a cycle. You know, that's how cyclic patterns are actually being created, that the energy of the past is actually running us and not anymore the connection to the future, like the higher inspiration. And I think that's an interesting conversation to have, and also for everybody who deals with the evolution of consciousness or development of higher states and stages, what are the practices to make it more sustainable in stressful situations? Is this possible at all? So that would be the next question.
Well, you know, I think that there's an ancient view that's part of popular culture and part of the commentators that I hear about the situation in Israel and Palestine and in many other problem places in the world, which is a kind of pessimistic view that it is cyclical, that things don't change. And yet really the whole premise of spiritual activism is the sense that it is possible for there to be real change and that a new higher consciousness can make a difference. And we certainly are seeing that it's not an easy thing to do, but that real change is possible under the circumstances we're familiar with. But we're familiar with the kinds of circumstances that we see in in Western Europe and in the United States and in Australia and Japan, and you know, the places we're familiar with, which are relatively peaceful and prosperous. And when we go into a situation where that basic physical safety and security is threatened, is undermined, and there's a shared field that goes into shock. Now, I think there's probably something pretty unique about Israel because the Jewish people have been subject to the Holocaust, and you know, there's this trauma that goes back even before the Holocaust of persecution, and so this sense of us together potentially being threatened has a special quality there. But nonetheless, it's to some degree a stand-in for any situation where civil order breaks down and where people's personal safety is threatened and everyone together gets scared. And if we can be, you know, if practitioners under those circumstances can make the larger pattern a different pattern, it's a much more hopeful situation than if the practitioners are dragged down to the lowest common denominator by the group field.
Right. And that's a very strong thing, like what you said, the last part, is how the collective actually supports either the stabilization or the disintegration of those higher functions. And because my experience was that when the collective fear is so strong, then of course it reinforces all the existential fear that comes up in our systems, and so this immediately creates a kind of a boosting effect, and all the other, if the whole, let's say, the center of gravity in the collective consciousness drops, so then the probability of a state being stable or a stage being stable is also, in my perspective, also going down. So it depends how strongly hardwired is already this new stage, even in our nervous system. I think that's really a question that we should explore, if these higher stages are really stable, or if they are stable in certain secure conditions, and are still subject to, you know, disintegration when they are still young, which means that they evolutionary wise are not that long around, like with a spiral dynamic screen or a second tier. How much we can count that that's really a stable wiring in our nervous systems, and therefore these are stable thoughts that we are having. It doesn't matter if we are threatened or not. And I think that's a very interesting, I found it at that time a very interesting exploration. And how can we stabilize the younger networks in our brains and bodies and emotions and thinking? What practices are helpful to stabilize it and to make it more resilient in the face of the collective regression? And I think that, you know, that when resilience is such a big topic at the moment in different political systems or in the face of global warming, for example, like that some systems are being prepared for a possible crisis.
Right.
Then that's what's the spiritual resilience or the consciousness resilience. And maybe that's also one of the most important answers, that who are the people that can stay open, creative, and inspired and connected to their inspirational future and to bring in new things, even if collectively we are being threatened. So what are the practices that help us? Yeah,
well, this is really deep, because you know you're asking big questions that seem on some level kind of very fundamental and even maybe abstract or big picture. But you were observing this in the midst of scooping up your little toddler daughter and your wife and wanting to make sure that your family was safe and only having 90 seconds. So you were subject to some of these same influences, and you were feeling the pull of that group field on them and on you, and you are a very developed spiritual practitioner who can open the field in a room of, you know, several hundred people in a way that affects the experience of a large group of people just on the strength of your own way of being, you know, under ideal circumstances. But under these circumstances of threat, you were dealing with very different dynamics. And what did you feel and see personally? How did it affect you? How did what were your, you know, in what ways was it sobering? In what ways did it just confirm the strength of what, of how you participate in life?
Yeah, it was basically both. It was, of course, I could also feel the, this, you know, when you hear the missiles explode over your heads, even if it is 1 or 2 kilometers away. But it's a very real experience, you know. It's something, you know, you, everybody runs into a safe place, and then you hear seconds later, you hear how an anti-missile system is catching missiles in the air. So, and that's fairly impressive, I would say. And like it immediately like confronted me, of course, with a very different life situation. On the one hand, and I could also feel it in my system, the, like how the existential fear starts to jump. And at the same time, there was this, like, I don't know, this sense of presence, or also this, you know, years and years and years of contemplative or meditative practice that were there at the same time. Like the presence of those, I don't know, thousands of hours of meditation were there at the same time, in a way, this deep inner presence. And that was, I found this when I witnessed this in myself and also in my surrounding. And I, of course, I'm someone that's constantly like practicing and also experimenting. So how much can I use the functions that I use normally in my work in those situations, you know, of
yeah,
keeping an open field, keeping an open field and grounding the whole situation first in myself and also in my surrounding, and also staying connected to the collective dimension. You know, when you hear in the
right.
radio, I don't know, every, you know, because the radio is the only source of quick information, not anymore only, but also the mobile phones, but everybody has the radio on, and then you hear constantly every few minutes, it doesn't matter what's the radio program, you hear, oh, there are sirens going off in this city and in this city and in this city, and then it becomes actually a 24/7 reality, even if it happens in your place only 3 or 4 times a day, which anyway is already a lot, and then you hear it, that it's going on in the whole country all the time, you know? It's like,
right.
it creates a constant psychological impact. And
right. Well, it's like you're living under siege.
Right, right. Even if, you know, basically, theoretically, there is a very highly developed anti-missile defense system. And so basically, the probability that something really happens is fairly small, and still it's a very strong and deeply impactful time.
Yes.
And so this was an interesting experiment, and also to feel, for example, how my own biological system, how the interplay between the collective let's say responses and contraction plays and affects my own system. And I felt that it really was very, that all my practice that I did was very important at that time to really be applied. Like it's something that I felt needs to be applied moment to moment to moment in order to keep keep everything open or keep everything, you know, stay present really to it, and also not to dissociate from this intensity, but to be in that intensity, but be there with the highest presence possible. And so for me, this was a very, very important time. I learned so much in that time, and it was not an easy time, you know, it was a challenging time, but for me it was an extraordinary, important experience somehow. It somehow gave me something that wasn't there before. That's the only thing that I can say.
And some of that was a little hard to verbalize because it had to do with the subtleties of how that foundation of hours spent in a kind of clarity and freedom were there as a resource to you during that experience of being in the midst of the threat and the group field's contraction, but also that you were noticing something about the dynamics of threat on a collective level and how it affects everyone.
Right. And that this humanity, like our humanity, our emotional experience, and our, you know, that we want to live, basically, and that we want to survive, and so that these are very strong powers in us, and I think that's this interplay between this transpersonal presence, but also the transpersonal higher subtle capacities, and this very personal, vulnerable, open humanness. That happens then also, of course, when you're in crisis situation, it happens with the people that are around you that you don't know, because suddenly you find yourself in a shelter with people that you've never seen before that are in the same situation with you. And it's very interesting connections or relational patterns that happen there. You know, when you're out on the street and then suddenly the sirens go off and you run somewhere and then you suddenly be totally different people that have nothing, you know, that you've never seen before, but suddenly you're in a very intimate situation.
You might die together.
Yeah, right. And a very unique circumstance. And, there are many small aspects to this that make this whole experience. You know, it's not just that you know intellectually that there is a war in the country, and it's not even, you know, the war was not even, you know, it didn't happen in Tel Aviv, really. The missions, yes, but
right.
Not the actual fighting was not in you know, in front of our house. But still, it's and I thought then, wow. If people, like when I think of also of other countries like Syria or, you know, countries in Africa, or when I think of, yeah, how it was also in the Second World War in Europe. And so when you are in these conditions for a long time, how impactful that is and how traumatizing that is, like how there is a deep impact in the human energy, let's say, that has serious consequences. And this was very clear to me that how this crystallizes itself, and generations of lifetimes need to deal with this. If it's really like, you know, like it was in Europe for years, or so that we are really dealing with those traumas on a collective level for a long time. And I think we need to find more effective ways of working with these things on a collective base. We are still in the Stone Age, you know, that we how we deal with collective woundings.
Well, this is sobering. I want to make sure you know how to find out more about Thomas Hubel's work. His website is thomashubel.com. That's thomashubel.com. thomashubel.com. He will be offering a free online teleseminar, The Mystical Principles of Healing, Integrating the Past, Presencing the Future. which taps into healing as a cultural activity and its potential for working with and transforming collective shadows and traumas. You can learn more about that by clicking the link in the email that announced this broadcast. Additionally, I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. Please sign up for my mailing list, which is different from the mailing list for Beyond Awakening, at my website, terrypatten, TerryPatten.com. I recently had a wonderful time talking about our lifetime journey into living more and more completely as love, because love is the engine of survival, as the poet Leonard Cohen has written. In my free online seminar, Activating the Integral Heart, I led Stephen Dynan in a 5-minute daily integral heart practice, one that you can do in less time on a daily basis, that I modified and created to help you activate and integrate all the dimensions of your being from the heart so that you can stabilize the higher states of innovation, creativity, and inclusiveness that your native heart intelligence generates. You can listen to that or download it again by clicking the link in the email that announced this broadcast. Also, I want to invite you to attend a remarkable series of events I'm going to be co-facilitating soon with Andrew Harvey, March 4th through 8th in Berkeley, California. Go to landing.terrypatten.com to find out the details. That's L-A-N-D-I-N-G, landing.terrypatten.com. Let's return to my dialogue with Thomas now. You'll remember that Thomas had just said some very sobering things about what he's seen about the generational legacy of collective wounding, saying that we're still in the Stone Age when it comes to dealing with its legacies. I faced the sobering implications of what he had said directly in my next question. Here we go.
Well, this becomes really so central because, you know, our world's in crisis on so many levels, and it seems inevitable that there will be real dislocations, real crises that involve real suffering that will affect people in every country in the world. Nobody can be completely immune as we go through this, and that the hope has been that these crises will open up windows of opportunity for positive change. But there are strong currents of fear that are going to be stimulated too. And if those are so overwhelming that the times when we ought to have a window of opportunity to more fundamentally redesign our systems become a situation where we respond from the least free, most contracted part of ourself, it's very discouraging. And how does
right.
this experience affect your view of that?
Yeah, that's what it was funny because we talked about this in a very small class that I gave before to some more core students here in Tel Aviv before it happened, like 2 or 3 months before, about this, how important will be that there are people in those crisis situations that are grounded and integrated, because that's another thing. If the energy system is not integrated and you become regressive, so then it's actually that what causes the collapse. And then, you know, you can maybe live for some time in a second tier consciousness, but if in those crisis situations your lack of integration in the lower levels is pulling you back, so then you find yourself in ways of acting, thinking, and feeling that are not equaling your current mature worldview. And so the integration process is so important. So therefore, I think that the shadow work and the integration work is so important that we can really trust that the foundation that we live in and on is stable. That we really talk to emotionally mature people around us that are able to take responsibility in those moments. And then, of course, to have a higher practice in place, and the best, of course, since many years, that that will enable us to stay open and connected, and also combine the inner science with the outer science, so that we are grounded and able to do all the actions and all the, you know, movement projects, whatever are needed in order to establish another way of living together as communities. And at the same time, to be also able to get the energetic work going that helps us to transform situations. Because as you said, there are cyclic patterns, but why are there cyclic patterns? Because unresolved traumas and issues of the past are simply looking for an integration. So if you look, okay, how does a shadow play out in a human being? It's an unintegrated circular energy that is looking for an experience in order to integrate itself. But if you look at this as wars on the planet, so that's actually what's happening all the time again and again and again. So that means that we as humanity didn't get one, in a way, one cycle integrated yet, and it's still calling for an integration on a collective level. And I think that the combination between a very skillful inner work and also energy work, like a consciousness energy work with higher capacities of subtle energy, and the outer work of grounded activists, people that work in the world and are able to ground projects, to lead in a proper way in those more massive crises, they are both important, you know, that we can keep the inner leadership and the outer leadership going.
And this experience helped give you insights about exactly how to do that?
Yeah. I think that somehow I learned something profound that I'm still working out, I think, what this means, everything. But yes, I think I... I got insights to both, I saw again how important is the shadow work and the grounding work, like how the embodiment work is important, how the higher, like keeping up a higher presence or a transpersonal, like witnessing consciousness state in a way, but also how important are the higher subtle possibilities that we have of healing integration or transformation to do that work also while you are in a crisis, and to have all of that in place. Because I think one way why life is also in a way going back to use more fundamental survival patterns is because they are simply faster. You know, when you have 90 seconds, you don't have so much time to think, should I go now to a shelter, should I not go, is it the right thing, is it the wrong thing, do I feel like this right now, or do I not feel like this, you simply run. And, you know, that's not the question. But this kind of basic patterns of survival give you the power to make a decision quickly, and not and also take leadership quickly, and not to, you know, now I need to meditate a few minutes before I know what I want. And I think there's also like an evolutionary reason. Life also needs this, of course. But it also might mean that it will shut down some higher functions that are very important for a more inclusive decision-making process. So
that has implications for all of us who have the idealism, the care for the world as one of our motivators and as to why we practice. It means that certain aspects of our practice, that we need to be serious and very real about certain aspects of practice that we might not have brought our attention to enough. And what comes forward to you immediately as aspects of what it is to practice, to stabilize the kind of consciousness and participation in life that is robust enough to withstand this kind of special intensity?
Yeah, that it needs to surpass in a way your survival drive. So that, like, it needs to be strong enough as a first priority in your life already that you won't be taken fully by emotional or collective movements. So that the first priority of practicing awakening or any kind of transpersonal practice means that I'll implement this in my life, no matter how strong are the other influences in my life, and I will be able to stabilize that as a part of me. You know, that even for some people, if their meditation practice grounds very often in the daily events, and then we find ourselves after a few weeks, I didn't sit for a long time. So if you are not able to implement the practice, no matter if it's a moment-to-moment practice or like a regular morning practice or like years of meditation in multiple retreats and, daily practice and moment-to-moment practice, so then it most probably won't be strong enough, because these forces in us are very strong. And if I don't have a facility of a transpersonal container in myself, so then I won't be able to keep up with this, because this will take over. And more so, everybody knows maybe in their life when there was a crisis situation that how challenging this is. But usually when you are in your workplace at a bad day and someone and the other people around you don't, so there's a stabilized field around you and you simply have a crisis. But if you have a crisis and everybody around you, or most of the people around you as well, there is no stabilizing factor. So the collective consciousness is just a field of possibilities, and it stabilizes itself in the one that life can maintain, where the center of gravity is stable. And so if the center of gravity around us is not stable, so then there is not much support for this higher function anyway. And so this needs people that are not anymore affected so strongly by those movements, because the first priority of our practice is stronger than that. And I talk a lot about the first priority because I think that's the key element. If awakening, or like looking through the dynamics of my emotions, my thoughts, my body sensations, my five senses, is not strong enough, in my daily life, in my regular daily life, it might appear, okay, I'm just living my life and it has ups and downs. But in more collective crisis situations, that's very different, because then I will not be able to be a focal point of presence, inspiration, a focal point of stability, keep up like a meaningful leadership, being able to hold the higher functions to see my enemies as well, as well as I see myself. So I think, and those are also the practices that I think are needed. Like this strong focus on that's something that will shine through my life, my practice, moment to moment, regularly, daily, and in intense periods, is something that is going to shine through the composition of my reality. And I think that's what will be needed, or what is needed ultimately, to shine through the composition of the crisis.
Is that the same thing that would help people to rise and be heroic under a crisis circumstance, or is that really a little bit of something different?
No, I think that's it. That's it. If wise means staying connected, having higher functions inform you and not your past. So if you, your past, your fear informs you in that situation, so that's not wise. This we had already. So we need something new. Usually people say, a wise leader is the one that brings in something new in a very challenging situation. So how do I keep up my channel where the new information can come in, the higher inspiration or the higher guidance can be there in a challenging situation? And it cannot only be there for myself, it's also there for me taking action in a collective environment. And so I think being heroic means that my presence is stronger than my fear. And being wise means that my light is stronger than my fear. So if light and presence, the causal and the and the higher subtle functions are still on while I'm in a crisis as a human being, that's what I think makes a wise, heroic leader.
Mm. Because it, you know, when you read, well, for instance, Viktor Frankl's great book, Man's Search for Meaning, on his experiences in the death camps in Germany after World War II, he described how many of the people in the camps were degraded and would just, you know, turn on each other and be very selfish and be drawn to a very low level of function, whereas others became saintly. And
right.
It seemed as though what he was noticing there was that it just turned on choice, on where one's heart and identity were, the nature of what one's stand is, as where one finds meaning, where one, you know, arrives at, such that, you know, I don't have choice about the outcomes, whether I survive or not, but I do have choice about the kind of human being I'm going to be. And,
right.
And people who see that and make a good choice become saintly or heroic. And that seems like that comes from a great depth in one, and there is a kind of awakening expressed there, but it's also very primal and even very earthy. It's just, I don't care what happens, I'm going to be a presence of love and courage to whatever degree I can, and that existential stand finds its way forward even under the stressful conditions. But when
right.
when you describe this about awakening, to some degree that might be about a certain capacity that is cultivated in meditation, sounds perhaps a little different, but maybe it's really the same thing.
No, I think that some people really bring already those qualities with them without, you know, having like a formal meditative practice. And, you know, some people, either they are very integrated as human beings already, and therefore they can keep up with their mature perspective also in a difficult situation. And I think some people simply bring already some sort of inner development into this life, of course, and that's already working. You know, that we say, okay, the human being remembers the, let's say, the development of the soul, and then it needs to develop forward. So if those rememberings, you know, bring us to a kind of a perspective and lifestyle that is holds already stably a very, like, a certain development, so then it will also be there in those situations. If, you know, if that's like already something that one can embody. And sometimes there are people that don't do a formal, like, spiritual practice, and still they are very developed in their inner worlds, and so that's what they can also count on when they are in such a crisis situation. So either that's already something that's naturally given to me through my karmas, or it's something that I need to work for in my life, or both. I think it's a combination.
Now, to what degree do you think those capacities can affect the larger field? Because in many situations, in most of the situations that we can envision happening in the world, there might be even, you know, a strong number of serious spiritual practitioners, but they're going to be a tiny percentage of the total population. And the great mass of people and how the great mass of people respond is going to be what determines the fate of everyone, because it's the mass of humanity that, you know, it's how we behave as a group that matters in many situations. So the premise has been that serious practitioners can have a disproportionate effect on larger groups, and the things like the meditation experiments done by the TM organization, where a large group of meditators would go to a certain city and meditate with consistency for a month to bring down the crime rate, you know, that kind of thing. So we know that there are some effects of that kind, but by looking at this up close, you maybe have a more realistic appraisal of just how substantial those effects can be and whether they're so small and marginal as to not be really the thing we can hang our hat on and put our hopes in. What, you know, or is this a very powerful effect? You know, how do you, how does your perspective on that question, how has it shifted, or where are you at in your contemplation of that question now?
I think synchronization is one of the key elements. That, you know, new developments become stable by sharing. So if one has a great idea but nobody listens, so this great idea will vanish. But if one has a great idea and other people resonate with it, so there is a kind of a heightened state of arousal, maybe, like a creative arousal that creates a field. And the field creates a wiring, and the wiring becomes normal. And so if we take this as one part of evolution, so we could say, okay, if there are all around the planet higher practices that help people to be more stable, and those people would synchronize through some, I don't know, through technology, for example, or through some inner technologies, and we know that we create this, it's a kind of a ritual, like a postmodern ritual, that we, you know, do massive meditations, that we do all kinds of practices that people sync up and create fields. And fields become wirings, and wirings become normal. So if that's something that we do, because when do you feel comforted? When you have somebody that you can talk to that understands you. So when you feel comforted spiritually is when you find another practitioner that knows exactly what you're talking about and shares with you this kind of inner state or experience or stage. And why do we say, okay, second-tier consciousness, only someone that is in second-tier consciousness will recognize someone else in second-tier consciousness, but they will drive on the same highway of life. You know, it's like these are the people that you meet again and again when you drive with your car on the highway, and then you see this red car again, and once it's slower, once it's faster, but they are driving with you approximately at the same speed. And that's basically the same thing. You recognize people that have a kind of a reference state or stage in themselves, and then people understand each other better. It's not that that's the truth about reality. It's only that you find people that share your values. But if it's true or not, we don't know. It's just that you think it's true because other people also see life like this. But this effect is actually very interesting because this effect is stabilizing. You say, if you see it like this, so there must be something true in it. So how I see life feels comforted by you seeing it similarly. And if we use this effect, and we, in a crisis situation, we practice also together, we are connected to each other, we can support each other of not losing those perspectives and stabilizing ourselves in it. So then we actually do the same what our brain does, that the neurons that actually wire together, so that we keep this inner wiring stable, so that it doesn't, that we don't leave it for more basic functions, but we use our basic functions, keeping up the higher functions. And I think synchronicity and connection and relational spaces are very important. So it's like as if you see towers of light in the coastal areas, and in the middle is just dark because there's ocean, but all around you see the lights, you know, and if they see each other, they remember that there are more of them. And I think that's what I would say is something important. And also that the power of higher development is, the next stage is not just a bit stronger, it's in its effect exponentially stronger. And so the creative force of someone living in a very strong inner connection is exponentially stronger than it's lost. And that's also something, I think, to count on, that higher development is more unstable because it's younger in evolution, but it's also more powerful when it's on. Mm. And so I would also trust this force.
Now, it reminds me then that maybe what you're talking about is a kind of network effect early on as evolution is proceeding. You know, Ken Wilber talks about how when 10% of a population reaches a new stage of consciousness, it has a chance perhaps to rewrite the rules of engagement in the public sphere. And there is research that shows that when a new attitude is coming into being, when it is held strongly by 10% of the population, its acceptance by the whole group, you know, accelerates and becomes much more rapid. It may be that a certain critical mass of higher consciousness knitting together and us feeling reinforced by one another gives us the capacity to begin to be a more powerful influence on the larger field, even if we are still numerically a small minority.
That's true. What I would call the mythical knowledge would say the future always has the power to rewrite the past, and so that the higher intelligence has the ability to rewrite the past patterns. But it needs to be coherent and strong enough for it. So same as when healing happens in an individual, it affects often, you know, the ancestors, parents and other people before. So I think that's the same principle, that when enough people hold those qualities so that it starts actually spreading and it's having a field effect, and then, you know, these basic rules can be rewritten. I think that's very true. I'm not sure about this, if it's always just 10%, if that's a rule, but the effect is definitely one that I would totally agree with, yes.
And does that it refine or evolve or in some way shift your own commitment as, you know, someone who wants the world to be healthy and for the world to be able to navigate the challenges and crisis moments to come? Does it connect your own teaching work and the spiritual work that you see us all involved in? Does it give you a clearer sense of purpose and resolve and ground it in some particular way that you can express even more?
I don't think so on one hand, because that's, you know, I feel simply my life is about that anyway. But it gave me, like, richness in it. Or it somehow, I know that something important happened for me there, but I don't think it's changed, something in my basic motivation. But it somehow showed me more facets, and also how, you know, to really, like, to look at this more safe and secure spiritual practice and how much we give ourselves also to confront ourselves with at the beginning it's the ugliness and the pain and the trauma and all the frictions in the world, but then this becomes in a way another part of life that we look at, and it just motivated me to look how much we might live in a bubble with creating spiritual field, or how much we are really in our spiritual practice, really look at closely at the marketplace, look at all the things in the world, especially now when we are on the verge to create an interior that is able to hold a global consciousness. So how much are we being overwhelmed by the what many people call the pain of the world or the suffering in the world? Or how much are we really looking at the suffering with the most loving care and clarity and presence even if one part of us wants to have, you know, to just enjoy the nice life that we have, especially when we live in very rich countries, but that we, like this more radical look at what I would call the shit of life, you know, when really all the shadows and all the, like when this gets activated, you know, all around the planet. So in small daily life situations that we all go through, and of course in crisis areas where there are collective burning topics, but it's I think this willingness to be comfortable and uncomfortable because we're committed to something greater. And I see more and more how that's one of the basic changes that I think needs to happen in a human being, that we stop avoiding and looking away from the discomfort of life, and that we really include this and learn to give it a home in ourselves. So maybe that's one aspect.
And perhaps that links to what you said earlier about when we see others able to be with that discomfort in a different way, we are stronger in our capacity, and if that stabilizes and we are stabilizing one another, we begin to be a matrix of clarity that can be a resource to larger groups of people too.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Thomas. This has been a conversation I really wanted to share with others, because it, I think it's about something very important, and I know we'll continue to be talking about this more. Is there anything more that you'd like to say, just in summary, as we complete?
No, I think thank you, first of all, for this time also, and yeah, I think we said so many things. I think somehow I have the feeling it's like the cup's full. I think everything that I would add now would be a repetition. So I think it was a rich conversation, and I liked your questions and own reflections on it. So I think it was a lovely dance.
Very much. I really appreciate what you've had to say here. It's a consideration that I hope we will take further. Because I think this sense that we have a responsibility to be a source of healing and sanity in the world is something we're taking it seriously, and if we're taking it seriously, we obviously have to grow in it. And so the consideration will be ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Thomas.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us today. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it too. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you're interested in learning more about Thomas Huebel, go to thomashuebel.com to find out more. That's thomashuebel.com. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter and find out about my upcoming teaching events. Thank you so much for joining Thomas and me today. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.